Good evening. When we're sitting, remember to fill your lungs when you inhale. You don't want to force it, but it makes quite a difference, actually, if you inhale completely. And then also when you exhale, many of you have heard Suzuki Roshi's suggestion that you put a little effort or a little strength in your hara at the end of the exhalation. So it just pushes the air out a little bit. And then relax the hara, and then the next breath starts. So I notice when I'm sitting at my temple, I can sometimes hear people breathing in a way that's quite, it's kind of shallow and fast, and we can fall into that very easily. So another way of engaging our effort in Zazen is to remember to inhale fully. Again, be gentle. The idea isn't to force anything, but to fill the lungs. And as you do that, the rate of your breathing will naturally slow down. And this affects how the body-mind responds to Zazen. So give that a try, if you don't already. I can just catch the aroma of the lavender here. Of course, things have various aromas that we encounter in our life, and it's so ordinary that we may lose sight of the miraculous quality of our daily experience. Noticing the aroma of the lavender, the question naturally arises, where is this coming from? There's nothing wrong with the, you might say, scientific explanation that is particles of microscopic, submicroscopic particles contacting the mucosa of the nasal passages and registering as an aroma. That's perfectly true, but it isn't quite enough. When you're sitting, the question may occur to you, where does it all come from? Also, where does it all go to? Our friend Dogen's great disciple Kōen Ejo. As you may know, he was older than Dogen, and he'd been practicing quite a while with a fellow named Dainichi Nonin, who was a Chan or Zen teacher of some standing in Japan at the time. And where Dogen went to China to see what was happening over there, Nonin wrote a poem, basically, expressing his awakening, and basically mailed it to some guy in China. And I don't know who he mailed it to, or if anybody knows, but anyway, whoever it was, apparently, you know, initialed the poem, yeah, good, and sent it on back. And so Nonin would, you know, present this as his certification as a really great teacher, which is a very strange process, but anyway, that's what he did. And so Ejo and some other folks who became disciples of Dogen had been practicing with Nonin. And when Ejo heard about Dogen, which some of the Buddhist establishment at the time wished no one had heard about Dogen, but people did. So Ejo decided to go visit Dogen, and he was kind of skeptical at first. But he says that when he met Dogen and they started speaking, they talked for hours together. And Ejo said he had never heard anyone talk the way Dogen talked about practice. And so he became Dogen's disciple and his first Dharma heir. And if you read some of what Ejo wrote, he actually didn't write very much, nowhere near as much as Dogen. But what he did write sounds uncannily like Dogen. And it's not because he was imitating Dogen, but because he understood practice the way Dogen understood it. He has a very beautiful work called The Treasury of Light, which I highly recommend if you run across it. And also another a beautiful essay called the Zazen Yojinki. And in that text, he says something like, Zazen easily allows people to illumine the mind and rest in their fundamental, inalienable inheritance. Note, he says, easily. So, the late Katagiri Dainin Roshi, who's one of the priest that Suzuki Roshi asked to come and give him a hand in the U.S., he liked to tell people, it's not like Zazen you do every day. So if you're thinking easily, no, that doesn't sound right. My Zazen is not easy. It might be, your understanding might be a little off. Ajo says, this easy practice is, I said, this is called showing the original face. Revealing the landscape of the basic ground. He says, body-mind falls away. And we have detachment, whether standing, walking, sitting, or lying down. Thus, we abandon good and evil. We transcend sacred and profane. We release all conceptions about delusion or enlightenment, and we leave the realm of Buddhas and sentient beings far behind. Now, does that sound like Zazen you do every day? Well, it is. Yeah, kind of. That is the Zazen you do every day. So that description is actually all about letting go. And it's about the letting go life, which is our actual life. And to the degree that we can approach practice in this fashion, it's ungraspable, magical quality will become something familiar. So his expression, illumine the mind, you might think you don't know what that means. But maybe I can't convince you to abandon that point of view. But you could ask yourself, well, when you get right down to it, what is mind if not light? And since we're taught body-mind is one suchness, then what is body if not light? Light. Edjo goes into some detail in his essay, The Treasury of Light. So if you can invite and allow yourself to sit with this kind of vastly open heart, and without trying to twist your Zazen into some shape that you can then recognize, I think you'll find practice a great deal easier. Sometimes when I see people practicing, it's like at the county fair, where someone is making animals out of balloons, it makes this kind of horrible squeaky noise. They're twisting around, And finally, they have a giraffe or whatever. And sometimes I get the feeling that people are approaching their practice that way. They could just never mind that horrible noise. Just twist it into something that you can recognize. But I would say instead, you know what? Leave it alone. It's already something remarkable just to be still. Just to be still and let the air into the lungs and out again. There's a kind of, a very old assumption that we should actually be doing something. And if you're not doing something, well, you're just some sort of slacker. So, to allow ourselves not to do anything in particular is an extraordinary gesture to make towards the universe of suffering beings. So Zazen easily lets you illumine mind. And rest in your basic inheritance. And that is going on right now. If they use the word, or if Ejo Senji uses the word light, as with practically every other expression, there's potentially a problem there. Because our usual understanding of light is that it comes from some source and enters the eyes. And again, it's not that that's not so, but if we settle for that single explanation, it's going to be hard for us to understand how the eye itself is light. You may be familiar with the Buddhist understanding of how the senses operate. So there are always three components. You know, there's the organ, there's the object, and there's an associated consciousness. So again, this isn't our usual understanding in the West. In the West, our senses are basically passive receptors of stuff coming at us. And if we limit ourselves just to that understanding, we'll have some trouble feeling like Ejo is talking to us when he says, Zazen lets the mind illumine. The eye is light, the ear is light, the nose, the tongue, the skin, the mind. Are of an ungraspable, light-like nature. So it's understandable if you know, maybe when we start off practicing, it's like we sit down and right away we're kind of chasing something. you know, more stillness or less noise or something. We're in hot pursuit. And, you know, you can do that if you want. You can do whatever you want. But as long as we're in hot pursuit, we're not really letting Zazen be Zazen. So there's also a special magic to people getting together to practice. And if we are getting together in this radiant frame of mind, then it's really magical. In addition to the lovely aroma of the lavender, I was hearing a beeping noise from far away. I don't know what that was. But again, where does that arise? Is it, it's way over there, and then it comes to my ear. Like, well, yeah, sort of, but actually, no. It's arising as this body mind is arising right now. So practicing in this fashion, body mind is already falling away. And we're leaving the realm of Buddhas and sentient beings far behind. Because of our basic inheritance. Sometimes we say Buddha nature, but we don't have to call it that. So Dogen says, practice like this, and your original face manifests. I'm not trying to confuse you guys, so if I am confusing you, I didn't mean to. It is perhaps easier to have a much more structured understanding of practice. And as you may know, there's a lot of Buddhism out there now, and some styles are very, very structured. And here's Edjo saying, "Chi, toss that stuff away." And sit as awakening, even though you don't know what that is.
Could you just say that because he had spent some time in the land of the structured?
Could Ajo say that because he'd spent some time studying structure of Buddhism?
Well, as far as I know, there isn't much indication that he did. Sure, he knew, the basics just like we do. But since he was studying with Dainichi Nonin, who was also, he was also a Zen guy. So my guess is he talked that way because when he spoke with Dogen, something was awakened. Now, Dogen was quite a learned fellow, very familiar with the Abhidharma Kosha, which is about as structured as it gets. But he definitely recognized that, as somebody famously said, the map is not the territory. So there's lots of maps, but none of them is the territory. The territory is the single suchness nature of body mind, and obviously you're there already.
When the Abhidharma talks about the I as a consciousness, so would it be correct for me to think, well, that's the stand-in for the whole apparatus of the way light enters the lens and biochemical, a lot of biochemical, bioelectrochemical things happen, and then and that's the active role of the eye.
If you like, of course, with the increasing sophistication of scientific study, our focus on reality, over a number of generations and centuries now has become more and more and more refined. And we're not at the end of that process yet by any means, but it seems though as the refinement has increased, there's less and less to grasp.
Right. I'm not saying there's anything graspable there.
Heaven forbid. Right. Did I see a question? Yes, Karen.
I've been trying to imagine the state that you've been describing, and it comes down to a pre-verbal infant. No concepts, no goals, no motivations, just pretty much being.
Yeah, I wouldn't call that a state, is all. So when we're speaking of Zazen, we're not talking about a state that you should acquire. So what you say is true, but concepts also are light. So when we're sitting, if concepts arise, this is not a problem. They're not something to be got rid of. Edjo's talking about leaving stuff behind, not eliminating stuff. He says, we can leave behind good and evil, sacred and profane, Buddhas and sentient beings, and not carry them anymore. You can't carry them anyway, but when we're sitting in this way that we've been taught, you can't carry anything anyway. That's what he means when he says leaving the realm of Buddhas and sentient beings behind. So this, I don't know, practice of no baggage is not a state. So I just want to make sure we're clear about that. Suzuki Roshi makes pretty clear that he says our point of our practice is not to have some special state of mind. You can, there's lots of ways to come up with special states of mind. You go drink a fifth of whiskey, you'll be in a special state of mind, definitely. But that's not the point of practice.
What is the point?
The point is that magic is happening now. And we can sit in that truth without being able to see this ungraspable light. We can still sit, you know, as the truth, basically. And you might say that's the point of practice. Yes. You guys have more elaborate equipment now.
We've become much more sophisticated.
I see.
Thanks to our brethren here at the Dharma Center who have all this fancy equipment.
Oh, many thanks.
Yes. So I was wondering about the role of inquiry in all this. I sat down tonight, probably because you're here. I thought body and mind dropped away. And then I thought, is that what this, I thought about, I had some inquiry, like, is that what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
So I had that inquiry in my mind. I said, is that what's going on? And so I was inquiring to myself about that.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, that's a well-known dynamic in Zen and Chan. The tricky part is not to arrive at an answer and then hang on to it. For instance, is my body mind falling away? Yes. Yes. Darn tootin', yes. I'm going to put that in my journal tonight. So the inquiry is a natural manifestation of our intention to practice for the sake of all sentient beings. And it's not the inquiry that is usually an issue, it's the answers that we get rapidly attached to.
We've been looking, for not the first time, at some of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra this fall. And one of the things that's it says in there is that, if a bodhisattva is afraid to ask questions about, isn't willing to ask questions about this, isn't willing to inquire, then that's not a good thing, or that's not productive of the bodhisattva path.
Yeah.
So this, I think that's interesting. I know when I first started practicing, I was definitely afraid to ask questions.
Oh.
Yeah. I know. I remember that I didn't want to ask questions.
Of yourself?
Of the teacher. And I think I had plenty of questions for myself, actually. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Dogen's extensive writings, he is constantly inviting us to inquire. And by that he simply means look. Look again and again and again and look deeper. It's not that you're seeking an answer. The looking in itself turns the Dharma wheel. Did you have a question?
I've got a really basic question, like the metaphor or whatever of seeing your original face. I've never quite gotten what that's all about. If I look in a mirror, am I going to see my original face, or is it how I see the world?
Well, the whole expression is your original face before your parents were born. So there's a little more to it than that. So this means, apart from our everyday assumptions about who we are and who others are. What is that original spark? Who are we before our parents were born? So you can look in a mirror if you want, but it's not really necessary.
You may already have responded to this, but it's been pointed out to me that this inalienable inheritance of which Ajo speaks sounds like it might be some fundamental core, unchanging entity. Could you comment on that? Why? And I see you disagreed.
Yeah.
Could you add anything to that? Why not?
The inheritance, this core, is that there is no core. That's one way to speak of our fundamental inheritance. There isn't a core. If you've been looking at the perfect wisdom literature, made pretty clear, nothing has a core. And that absence of core is our original inheritance and the unfolding path of freedom, of liberation. Something like that. Yeah. Pardon me if I've got my watch here. I don't know. Maybe I've been talking long enough. And yes.
So the experience of feeling and the thoughts that arise from that feeling, is that an inheritance?
Let's see. When you say feeling, do you mean like an emotion? Is that what you mean by feeling? Or sensation? Or I just want to make sure I understand your question.
Well, the feeling can come from anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
it can come out from the out, from the external, or it can come from the internal.
Well, another way to say it is the inheritance is the actual nature of things. So if we look at the phenomena of our life, our experience, in terms of the five skandhas as the Buddha taught, or in some other way, we can't find anything that is unchanging. So that is another way of speaking of our fundamental inheritance, that truth, that you can't find anything that is not in flux and dependent upon other things that are in flux, on and on and on. And that's just not the nature of stuff out there. It's this nature too. So that, you could say, is our inheritance. Did you have a question? No?
Yeah. If there is no core, then what is it that is, if reincarnation exists, what is it that's getting reincarnated?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. how do Buddhists know that reincarnation is a fact?
Well, I don't know if they know that it's a fact. It's a story. And quite a while ago, I was taught that actually reincarnation is not quite the right term, because that does sound like there's, you know, somebody hopping from life to life. So I was taught to say rebirth. What it seems that there is conservation of energy and momentum. So a given life of a sentient being, has momentum. And we are taught, or there's a story, that momentum continues beyond the arising and passing away of a particular body. Now, is that a fact? I actually don't know. I may find out, or I may not. But it is a story that is kind of useful. And in terms of what happens to us as our life expires, it's about as good as any other story. And to my way of thinking, quite a bit better than some others that I've heard. So I'm sure you've heard the traditional metaphors like, well, you know, if you light a candle with another candle, the new flame isn't exactly the old flame. Right? It's also not the old flame. So there's some sort of unfolding process that is beneath, isn't quite the right word. I don't know, inside of, beneath, around the arising and passing away of a particular body. So that's the story. And that's a favorite Buddhist story. But in terms of its factual content, I don't know.
Yeah. Hello.
Hi.
You were talking a while ago about the coreless core. How does someone live that life? How do you move from there?
Well, in a way, that's the easy part. You just live your life. You don't have to make some special adjustment. That's how life is. And to know that, and to have our practice make that clearer and clearer, that's enough right there. So we also have some tools to assist us, like we have 16 bodhisattva precepts, which are a reflection of this truth. But how we are living is that truth unfolding. And again, to know that makes a difference. And Dogen says, you know, your practice is verified in the practice thereof. Right? Not your practice is not aimed at some eventual verification. Your practice is verified in the practice thereof. So, yeah, I know this may sound a little slippery here, but you know, that's just the way it is. Okay, maybe one more question. Yes?
I, like Kenny, also was always puzzled by that original face.
Yes.
Before you were born. But then
Before your parents were born.
Yeah,
it's even worse.
The question that, no, it actually clarified.
Ah, okay.
The question about reincarnation triggered something for me. It's all those causes and conditions before I was born that brought me to my original face.
Well, yeah, kind of. But the thing about your original face is that nothing and no one had to bring you to it, or it to you. This is your original face is before all that stuff, way before. So it's just a little tweak there. Yeah. Well, you all are so peaceful and quiet. It's like we could just spend the night here. Sitting still, but maybe we'll go home instead. Thank you very much.